Welcome back to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. I am your host, Toby Daniels. On this week's episode, we have a very special guest, best-selling author, entrepreneur, and marketing Hall of Fame member, Seth Godin. During our conversation, we discussed his latest book, This is Marketing. You can't be seen until you learn to see. We covered a lot of ground in this particular conversation, including why he believes tension is so important in marketing, why empathy is overlooked as a core strength of any great marketer, why he's encouraging us to shift our focus to the smallest viable audience, and what he thinks is at the heart of great storytelling, and how we can rise up against the evils of marketing. For those of you interested in hearing more from Seth, he will be our closing keynote speaker at Social Media Week New York this May. Stay tuned for later in this episode for a very special offer to attend this event, which is only available for Leads to Scale listeners. And as always, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale on your favorite podcasting app. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to the podcast, Seth. Thanks so much for joining.
A pleasure. Thanks for coming all this way.
So in preparing for our conversation today, I was thinking about what your work has meant to me over the sort of two decades or so that I've been sort of working in marketing, media, technology. And, you know, I've read or perhaps listened to most of your books over that sort of time, and I've been an avid follower of your blog. I've seen you speak countless times. And when I look back and I sort of think about it and reflect, I'm sort of struck by one kind of consistent idea that seems to kind of run through a lot of your work, which is this idea around how important it is to challenge conventional thinking. And I've sort of got to this point when I sort of think about my own business and how we serve the needs of marketers around the world, where I sort of have this like nagging voice in my head that sort of consistently asking me this question, which is, what would Seth say?
That's very nice.
And rather than this necessarily just being a setup to the conversation or even an opportunity to pay you a compliment, it's more about like, is this how you see yourself as a sort of a nagging influence, as someone who is continually course correcting people?
No, not at all. But maybe I'm responding to the word nagging. Here's the thing. I don't think you have to challenge conventional wisdom if conventional wisdom is working for you. That if the system as it exists is exactly what you need it to be, then run with it. So if you're Ford Motor Company and it's 1953, you're not looking forward to the invention of the Tesla. You don't need the invention of the Tesla. You need the world to have three big car companies and you're going to get more than your share. But most people, just on a headcount basis, would be better off if the world changed for them. And so what I've been saying to people, and I'm not nagging them at all, is if you know what you want and what you want would work better if you could create a different environment where there's more connection or more trust or more confidence or more appropriate technology for your needs, go do that. And if you don't, then don't. But if you're not enrolled in this journey, I don't need to talk to you. So that's why I don't think it feels like nagging. But the idea of what would Seth say comes back to a post I wrote 10 years ago about mentors and heroes. I've got a ton of heroes and they're in my head all the time. What would Abe Lincoln do today? What would Michelle Welch do today? That idea that we can ask ourselves that question, that's thrilling.
I guess given the breadth of work, I mean, was it like 18, 19 books at this point? And it just covers so much subject matter. Given the breadth and given the time span over which you've been, you know, publishing your work, what to you has been kind of consistent throughout?
Yeah, about five books into it, I realized there was an arc developing because I don't want to just be taking pot shots at this and then easily distracted into that. I do that on my blog for sure. There's not as much of an arc on the blog because there's 7,500 posts. But the arc continues to be about habits, leverage, respect, dignity, and the way culture changes us and the way we change the culture. And so that means that each individual has to be responsible for their work, and it means that each individual has a chance to make the culture better or worse. And when we add those things up, we can do it for money, we can do it because we care, we can do it for both reasons, but I think we can't say, I'm just doing my job.
So your latest book, This Is Marketing, what does that represent for you in terms of the arc and where you are today? Is it a culmination of something? Is it a jumping off point? Like, where does it sort of fit into the broader narrative?
Yeah, it's mostly a culmination in the sense that my publisher was generous in letting me bring all of the threads together. But I also think I was right a lot for the last 30 years. And I ignored the parts I was wrong about, but there was a bunch of things I said before most people said them. When we add them all up, now they seem obvious. It seems obvious you shouldn't spam people. It seems obvious that you can do, that you can lead a small group of people. So if I compiled those and then added to it this overall arc about what does it mean to even do marketing, that felt to me almost like a testament that I decided to write the book when I was sitting at the Marketing Hall of Fame induction ceremony, because I'm looking around, I'm like, they don't invite young people to do this. This is what you get at the end. Mm. And I'm like, well, maybe I ought to just sum it all up, because I think there are a lot of people, I certainly meet them, who needed to hear this because they were missing key pieces.
So I want to dig into a number of themes that I think are like incredibly relevant to this audience and to our listeners. But before I do, just give us the high level sort of summary of This Is Marketing.
This Is Marketing says that marketing is not advertising, marketing is not spam, marketing is not selfish. Marketing is the work we do when we tell a true story to change other people for the better. No change, no marketing. That's the only purpose of marketing, is to make change happen. You can make change happen with the product you make. You can make it happen with the stories that you tell to people you engage with. And marketing revolves around two questions: who's it for and what's it for? Because you can't change everybody, and the change has to be specific. And if you can start with that, then a whole bunch of other pieces come together. But as someone who talks to more marketers every day than most people on earth, I was astonished, remain astonished, by how ignorant and selfish most people are. Not because they're willfully either one, but because they don't get it. And once they get it, life gets way easier.
So Do you carry frustration with you in that regard? I mean, do you bring an amount of like frustration to this type of project in terms of what's like the driving kind of motivator? The saying, okay, I need to do this because people need to, I need to change people's kind of, right. Change people's mindset.
And yeah, I used to. There was definitely frustration in some of my work 10 or 15 years ago. Now it's gone. Right. I mean, like, When I got an email 20 minutes ago from a spammer who calls herself a publicist saying, this person would be a great guest on your podcast. Well, as you know, I don't have guests on my podcast. As she should know, I don't, but she's spamming a list. And so what I should do is just delete. But sometimes I'll hit reply and say, have you ever listened to my podcast? The thing is, that is coming out of frustration, because healing one person at a time is not the way to solve the universe. But in my writing, I view myself more as a teacher only for people who are enrolled in the journey. And that's the beauty of a book. No one reads a book accidentally. And I think it's one of the shifts in social that people are starting to see, which is you can't reach everyone. So you're only going to reach the people who are going somewhere anyway. Just talk to them.
So I want to build on that a little bit. So when at least I think about the last like two decades of like technological innovation, disruption, call it what you will, especially in regards to kind of its impact on marketing, it's clear to me, and I think you'd probably agree, is that marketers in general are very quick to jump on like new trends and chase sort of shiny objects, which is often the kind of the path that leads them to where, leads them to a point where a lot of their sort of practices start to feel kind of like spammy, regardless of like the medium through which they're kind of trying to communicate with customers. And
through that process, as we go down that path, we sort of, as marketers, tend to sort of stray from the fundamentals of what you describe as great marketing, right? Which is to sort of make change on behalf of those that we serve. So why do you, I want to sort of dig into, why do you think that happens? Why do we stray? Why do we go down these paths? And when you sort of look back and think about like permission marketing, Purple Cow, and obviously now This Is Marketing, were these designed to be kind of like course correcting sort of projects for you in terms of like helping sort of the average marketer to sort of get back on track and think more about the fundamentals of what makes great marketing?
So it's a juicy question, but let's get some semantics right here. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone is a marketer because we are trying to make a change happen. If you make a thing, if you run an organization, if you raise money for a nonprofit, if you're a teacher, you're a marketer. So when we say most marketers, I need to say most marketers don't think they're marketers. Most marketers don't follow trends. Most marketers don't buy ads, and most marketers aren't on social trying to get their click count up. But you are correct that there's a bunch of lemmings who are busy looking for the next trend because they're lazy. And they believe correctly that if you get on the next trend quick enough, you can build a short-term asset. And one of my favorite examples is the stupid Oreo tweet from Super Bowl 4 years ago, whatever. Everyone talked about how brilliant that was. It didn't sell one extra cookie, not one. It wasn't marketing. It was entertainment for a tiny group of marketers. That's different. So when I'm writing a book, I'm writing for somebody who's aware that there's something they want to have happen. And I know that that book's going to be around for 10 or 20 years. So what I'm saying to that person is, if you are willing to spend 3 or 5 or 10 hours reading this, I will change the way you see things. Don't look to me for trends. Don't look to me for tactics. Look for me for shining a light on something you didn't see before in a thoughtful way. And then after that, it's on you.
So let's dig into sort of a couple of the themes in the book. Tension was one concept that I think you talked about that I just thought was really fascinating, and you sort of describe it as a forcing function and how people choose to make decisions about becoming your customer or about purchasing your sort of products or services. Why do you think that like tension is so important in marketing?
Yeah, no one talks about this, and I was amazed as I started writing about this that no one talks about this. If you want a rubber band to get from here to across the room, there is no way to do it without stretching it first. And when you stretch a rubber band, part of it wants to get back to where the other part is. That's how you shoot a rubber band across the room. Well, so if we say Springsteen on Broadway closes in 2 weeks, it makes it way more likely that someone's going to go buy a ticket. Why? Because they don't want to miss it. That I don't want to miss it is another word for tension. There's also the tension that someone feels just before they say yes to buy something. The tension of this might not work. I might be stupid. I might be wasting my money. I might be embarrassed. Tension is present whenever change is present. So if you are allergic to tension, if you say, I am not willing to inflict tension on the people I serve, you've just acknowledged you can't change them. So the teacher changes the class by creating tension. You're about to be left behind. You want to listen to what I'm about to say? And that's a service. That's a generous thing to do. It's not a selfish thing to do. It's only become selfish when you manipulate. And manipulation is possible, but not a good idea. Manipulation says, if you knew what I know, later you would regret doing what I just asked you to do. That's different than saying, if you know what I know, later you'll be glad I taught you what I just taught you. That's the fork in the road for marketers when they create tension.
So another concept which I loved is this sort of idea of the empathetic marketer. My reaction to that, particularly when I sort of think about social media, is that, you know, it affords us an opportunity as marketers to be more empathetic, to listen more than we necessarily broadcast and push content and push messaging out into the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what happens and that marketers do become more empathetic. It's just the opportunity that may or may not be sort of capitalized on. Can you just sort of expand a little bit on what you mean by the empathetic marketer?
Sure. So practical empathy. If you do a thing that looks like a marketing campaign and it doesn't work, that's because you were being selfish. if you do a thing that looks like a marketing campaign and it does work, it's not because the people who engage with you like you. It's because they like themselves. So what we must do to engage with people who are voluntarily engaging with us is we have to look at them and say, I don't know what you know. I don't want what you want. I don't believe what you believe. And that's okay. And if you can't add the last line, which is the empathy line, then why would they listen to you? No one can market by scolding people. We market by being able to go to people and say, I know you have a different point of view, but maybe if you heard what I'm about to say, you'd want to do this anyway. And, you know, there's so many ways to think this through, but it gets to undermining what I think is the myth of authenticity. People don't want you to be authentic. They want you to be consistent. They want you to make a promise and keep it. And one way to think about this is think about toys for toddlers, for three-year-olds. None of them are designed by three-year-olds. So whoever designed them had to make a toy that a parent wanted to buy and a kid wanted to play with. It had nothing to do with the authentic vision of the designer and everything to do with the empathy for what the parent is feeling at the store and what the kid is feeling at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I actually want to build on the authentic piece, because I think it was on the Tim Ferriss podcast, you talked about authenticity versus professionalism. Right. This is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's a kind of a worthwhile one to go on. So yeah, you talked about authenticity, and authenticity is like overrated, and like professionalism is something that we need to sort of like look at much more closely if we are really going to be sort of judgmental of the services that we're, you know, being provided with. Can you talk about that? I think you shared a great example, and I'd love my listeners to hear it.
Well, you know, think about the house where you live. If the roof is leaky, and it's because the roofer was getting a divorce the week that he was installing your roof, and you just didn't really feel engaged with roofing, you have no sympathy, and you're not happy, even though he was being an authentic roofer in the moment. What you wanted was a roofer who would keep his promise, a roof that doesn't leak. That's the way we engage with just about everyone, except for this tiny subset of sort of Instagram me celebrity kind of people who were just watching for the drama of their, quote, authenticity. But even that isn't truly authentic, because on days when they're super happy and saying, I'm just making a lot of money, they're not tweeting about that. So it's all drama. We don't want George Clooney to be authentic when he's in a movie. We want him to make a good movie. And we think the same thing about roofers and chefs and people who run nonprofits. Show up, do your work. You can be authentic with your friends.
So another concept that I've been wrestling with from the book is this sort of idea of the smallest viable audience. And it's not because it's a concept that I disagree with. I totally get it. It makes a ton of sense. But, you know, putting myself in the shoes of the types of marketers that we are serving, you know, they are, or we are, collectively driven by this sort of idea of scale and reach and audience growth as being like key factors to success, which of course, you know, I totally understand is like incorrect. But the concept of the smallest viable audience is just such a deliberately like counterintuitive concept. I'd love for you to kind of spend some time of like, you know, helping me and, you know, our audience understand the kind of the mindset shift that you're sort of trying to encourage us to make.
So thank you for teeing this up. If this was a Google Doc, I would highlight that you just used the word incorrect and put a comment next to it saying, yes, yes, yes. The object is not more, the object is better. Because if you can do better, more will take care of itself. But if you obsess about more, better falls away. That one of the biggest ideas in the book is you're never going to reach 7 billion people. You're not even going to reach a billion people. So we've already acknowledged that almost everyone on earth will not hear of you or from you. The people say I'm well known, 99% of the people in the United States have never interacted with anything I've ever done, 99%. So begin with that and realize that you're not gonna get everyone. So who will you be able to engage with? Well, if you can engage with a group of people who are aligned in their dreams and their visions and their goals and the way they are in the world, and you can delight them, overwhelm them with the better, they will tell their friends. That is marketing in one sentence. Because if you're so worried about more, then what you'll do is average it out. What you'll do is dumb it down, because that's what more looks like. More and average are the same thing. But if you're average, why would anyone talk about it? If you're average, why wouldn't we want something like you make but cheaper? So what Amazon is teaching us is that sort by price is not your friend. You can't win sort by price. You have to be the one that is the only one, the one we will look for specifically. Why will we look for you specifically? Because you chose the smallest audience you could live with. You delighted them. And then something came up around that was even bigger than that, not because you interrupted other people, but because the people you serve told the other people.
Do you ever look, I mean, you're sort of a very case study focused writer, and you reference tons of case studies in your work. Do you ever look at the case studies that are in many ways working kind of against your own ideas and your own concepts that are actually successful, you know? And
oh, that's where I always start.
Right.
The counterexample is key. But so tee one up. I'm happy to hear it.
Well, I mean, there are so many examples of mass, right?
No, give me one.
Well, I mean, I guess Walmart.
Okay. So when was the last time you went to Walmart?
I've only ever been once.
Right. And I haven't been in years. Walmart's not for us.
Right.
Now, notice that smallest viable audience doesn't mean seven people. It means the smallest number of people you can serve to do the work you want to do. So Sam's vision was very specific. His vision was go to the under-retailed communities and figure out how, first among all things, to ratchet down in price, to maintain quality and ratchet down in price. How many stores do you need to do that? You need more than 10, because otherwise you have no leverage against P&G. But Walmart doesn't try to serve you or me. When I spoke at Walmart in 1999, they had a huge banner 100 feet across, and it said, "You can't out Amazon, Amazon." Think about that. The biggest retailer in the world. Amazon's coming up loud and clear. Let them go. We can't be, they're not part of our smallest viable audience. They will be who they are. We will be who we are. And every time Walmart loses that thread, they get into trouble because they stop serving that audience that depends on them, that they depend on. So I don't think they're a counterexample at all. They're just a big example of a small audience.
Yeah, and I think that's where people might struggle a little bit with the sort of idea of the smallest viable audience, just conceptually, because
right.
I think
well, here's the problem. Like Macy's is doomed because not tomorrow, but their audience is anyone who has money. Mm-hmm. And the problem is people who have money have many, many choices. And if Macy's in Toledo disappeared, we'd find somebody else to take their place. What we know is that when a Walmart disappears, the whole town falls into a tailspin because Walmart showed up, wiped out all the local retailers. There's no alternative. And they closed a bunch of Walmarts last year and it wiped out a bunch of towns because you would miss it if it was gone. Fewer people would miss Macy's if they were gone. And so that's why Macy's is waking up and saying, how do we become unique, special, idiosyncratic, as opposed to general? Sears is gone. Sears was not about the smallest viable audience. Sears was about everyone, and now they're gone.
We interrupt this week's episode of Leads to Scale to share an update in regards to our forthcoming conference in London, the 10th annual edition of Social Media Week London, Europe's premier conference for media and marketing professionals, is taking place at the QE2 Conference Center in Westminster between October 31st and November 1st. This year's event will continue the 2019 global theme Stories with Great Influence Comes Great Responsibility, a conversation that will explore how social media has become the most influential story platform in the world that has the power to both unite and divide us. Check out our first wave of speakers and secure your pass by visiting socialmediaweek.org/London. And don't forget to use the code LEADS2SCALE at the checkout to save an additional 10% off your pass. All right, let's get back to the show.
I spent some time going down the rabbit hole of book reviews. You've published a bunch on your site, but I also looked elsewhere as well. And actually, it's sort of, you know, I don't typically do that unless I'm having these types of conversations with book authors. But it was incredibly interesting to sort of hear the perspectives of other people who read the book and how the work has like impacted what they're doing. And there was one guy, Raymond Ray, who wrote something I thought was super relevant and particularly relevant to the conversations that we're having through Social Media Week. And also in relation to our theme in 2019. And I'll just like quote from the review. So he said that with the increased use of social media platforms, many marketers have focused on the masses. We want to be like everybody else. We focus on likes, tweets, views, shares, and other things that have little long-term meaning. We're focused on looking at the other gal and comparing sizes. We're focused on looking at our one retweet compared to thousands, the thousands that celebrities receive. And to me, that, you know, this extract from your book really gets to the core of what's wrong with social media today. But obviously, given the power and the influence it has in our lives, and also, I suppose, the role that it plays in marketing, it's obviously a really fundamentally important part of like the broader communication landscape. So my question really is, like, what's your advice as we sort of think about the inflection point that we're at? And I'm talking about from the perspective of the industry and as sort of professionals and practitioners of that industry.
So love this question. I'm going to talk about this a little bit when I talk about it on stage. But here's the deal. There's a math equation. The math equation is we would like people to engage with us and pay us money or come to our event. In order to do that, we need to tell people a story. In order to do that, they need to listen to us. In order to do that, they need to follow us on social. Therefore, my job is to get people to follow me on social. Ah, the flaw in the math. That is not your job, but it's easy to believe that's your job. So the question is, what does Jack Dorsey or what does Mark Zuckerberg want you to do? What they want you to do is put on a show in social media that engages other people to spend more time and attention listening to you. But what we've discovered is that if you use enough data and test enough, every website becomes a porn site sooner or later, because you just get, you know, more scatological. You go down to the basement as fast as you can. That will get more purient interest, which will get more clicks, which will get more people to look at it or pick a fight with someone. We know, for example, that podcasts where people are fighting with each other have way more listeners than podcasts that don't. Fine. We know the formula to get more of the beginning of the funnel. Doesn't matter, because you forgot to do the math, which is someone who shows up for that, are you able to bring tension to them so they will go to the next step in the funnel? That person, are they likely to ever change? That person, the browsing person who's driving by and window shopping, will they ever engage with you to make the change you seek to make? If the answer is no, then not only have you wasted your time with them, but all those shenanigans you were doing have driven away the people you actually seek to serve. And so if we want to look at it in the real world, most people listening to this have heard of the Allen & Company event that takes place every year in Idaho, where the masters of the universe all come to meet with each other. Do we think that if they moved it from Idaho to Manhattan and opened it to anyone, that more people would come? Of course. If more people came, would it be better? Would it accomplish Allen and Company's objectives better? Of course not. That's obvious. So with all that said, tell me again why you're measuring how many YouTube views you have. There is no reason to do that. There is no reason to tweet in a way that gets you more Twitter followers. Zero. That's not your job. Your job is to find the people who are enrolled in your journey and take them to a place where you can help them change. And what I've discovered in my own life is a blog post that spreads more, not a blog post I hear about 5 years later from someone who says, I read that 5 years ago or 3 years ago, and here's how I put it to work. Those blog posts often seem like my least popular ones, but they got read by my subscribers who are enrolled in this journey, and I was able to do my work. It's not selling them something, because that's not my work. My work is to help them change to who they want to change to. And so every time I'm writing a blog post and tempted to make it a popular one because I know how, I don't, because I want to make it a better one instead.
So actually segues nicely, because I want to talk about storytelling and storytelling and the importance of narrative is something that comes up a lot in a ton of your books, and definitely something you touch on, and this is marketing as well. So our global theme this year, this is sort of our attempt actually at trying to sort of like elevate or lift the conversation up and beyond just obsessively talking about kind of tools and platforms and technologies, and instead talking about things that are much more universal and important as we think about our role as marketers. And our theme this year is stories. And it's something that we sort of unpack and will be sort of exploring through 25 plus conferences on six different continents around the world.
Wow.
And stories, we have a sort of a tagline, I suppose, which is with great influence comes great responsibility.
Love that.
And it speaks to this
tip to Stan Lee.
Exactly. And it speaks to this idea that we are a product of the stories that we consume. And so as marketers, the stories we tell, the content that we put out into the world has consequences, sometimes good and sometimes bad. What do you think is at the heart of great storytelling, and what role do you see storytelling playing in marketing?
Storytelling is so misunderstood because at the simplest level, it starts with once upon a time and ends with happily ever after. But if you look at Pixar shorts, and I'm thinking of two, the very first movie they ever made about a lamp, and the more recent one that took place in Hawaii that involved a volcano, there are no people in either one, right? But you might be in tears at the end. So what happened here? There was no film. It was just bits on a screen, and there are no people. Is that a story? Okay, fine. It's a story. But it's also a story to walk past the beloved store, see that it's closed, and it says, thanks for all your patronage. The owner just passed away. So there's only 9 words on the little sign, but there's a story there. And it's such a complicated story. It involves the fact that 3 years ago you argued with him about $4 on a shoe repair, and now you feel badly about it. It's all this complicated semiotics and flags and nuance. That's a story. And so when I think about the story that this generic shoe company that sold me a pair of shoes because they were the cheapest tells me, it's a story that says, I don't care about shoes. These were cheap. Compare that to the Adams shoes that I have at home that were made by an immigrant from Pakistan who I met once and who's built a company based on the fact that there used to be a shoemaking industry in Pakistan. And if you get a job doing that, you're much less likely to end up doing something else. All these things happen. And I get to tell myself that every time I put on the shoes. Those are what those shoes are for me. So when we're sitting around the table, when there's only 2 people in the organization and it grows to 100 or 1,000, and the CFO comes along or the marketing person comes along and they say, we need to run more ads, we need to cut this cost. I'm like, no. We need to live a better story. We need to live that story in a way that's true, that we can consistently deliver on. If you get that part right, everything else is much easier.
So a minute ago, you talked about this, the journey, and you know, the sort of the idea that as marketers, we're inviting people on a journey. And of course, you know, the narrative, the story, you know, is interwoven into that journey. And one of the things that kind of I've been thinking about a lot is where time and our attention kind of fits into all of that. Because the decision that someone makes, a customer makes to join you on this journey, is also a decision about
yep.
time and attention.
Exactly.
And time and attention are under assault
yep.
At the moment. And I think you have some really fascinating things to sort of to say about this, partly from your own personal perspective in terms of how you think about your time and how you think about the things that you, the journeys that you go on ultimately, but also then how that, you know, relates more broadly to people in general.
So in 1998, I wrote a book called Permission Marketing, and the thesis is that anticipated personal and relevant messages always do better than spam. It's way easier to engage with someone if they welcome you into their house than if you are running around testing the windows to see if they're locked. And most marketers, being short-term selfish narcissists who have blamed their bosses for the fact that they're spammers, are running around testing all the windows to see if they're locked. How can I possibly gain a flash of insight or of attention? How can I run an ad on top of the urinals at the conference because then maybe someone will see my ad there? But it takes more patience and guts and investment to be invited into the house. Because if you're invited into the house, human beings are still capable of bringing some attention and then trust. And trust and attention are the key currencies of marketing. So with that said, the challenge we have is we can't tell our whole story in 140 characters. All we can do at the beginning is help the prospect, the customer, see themselves, see something that they've always wanted to take them to the next step and the next step and the next step. The entire journey is going to be a selfish one, right? So if here's a book called Learn How to Juggle, 4 words, and you've never wanted to know how to juggle, you're not going to pick up the book. So you're not going to go on the journey. You're not going to hear the story. You're not going to encounter any of the, right? But if we compare that to how I raised myself from poverty to riches, that book might not get picked up by someone who wants to be rich, but it could very well be picked up by someone who feels down, someone who wants to, a hero's journey. It's the same number of words, but it implies a different story and who wants to go on that story with me. And so I think the hard work here is not what most people who you're engaging with are spending their time doing. Figuring out what the next Twitter trend is, figuring out how to understand Google Analytics, figuring out how to slam people through a squeeze page. You should promote yourself. Don't do that job. Do the job above that job. And the job above that job is, why would anyone care? How do I show up in a way that people would care? Not about me and how hard I'm working, but about them and how hard they're working. Because that is what the independent, selfish consumer is doing, paying attention to the voice in their head.
And, you know, through our conference, of course, and through a lot of our programming, there is just generally a fascination and borderline obsession with like measurement and analytics and all the ways in which we're trying to sort of determine whether like these programs are like working and performing or not. And it's just so obvious that we're just spending time looking at and measuring entirely the wrong things. I mean, ultimately, if the goal is to create change, why aren't we measuring that?
Exactly. And so let's look at the recent experience of the last 3 years, which has poured an enormous amount of money into this industry, which is venture-backed, direct-to-consumer businesses that sell commodity-like products. Mattresses, pharmaceuticals, erectile dysfunction drugs, you get the idea. Here's what happens. Raising a bunch of money isn't that hard because every once in a while it works. How do we spend the money? We spend the money to make a little bit of a splash. That's low-hanging fruit. Those people show up because they've been waiting for the chance to buy a mattress online. That was an easy sale. That gets the investors excited so you can raise your next round. So now you have more money to spend. You go back and do what you just did, it stopped working. Why did it stop working? Because all the low-hanging fruit's been picked. And because you have 3 competitors who also sell mattresses or whatever it is, picking the same fruit. Oh, what are we going to do? Subway ads. And the purpose of the Subway ads or the billboards or whatever else is to get more Twitter followers so it can show the investors we're making progress. This is what Jeff Moore calls the chasm. And it's not new. And shame on anyone who invested in one of these companies without reading the book first. Crossing the chasm is really straightforward. Early adopters want something because it's new, and the rest of us want it because it works. And what does it mean for it to work? Well, we know a mattress works, but does the story work? What do I tell my spouse? How do I get prompted to know that I even need a new mattress? How does the word spread? And ever since the Brady Bunch went off television, it hasn't spread because you bought TV ads. It has spread because people like us do things like this. Your neighbors have spoken up. You've seen the delivery truck on your street 10 times. Oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing now. Crossing the chasm is dangerous and difficult and expensive and time consuming. And if your investors don't want you to do that work, you're out of luck. And so let's go all the way back to, you know, early days, Blue Apron. Why did Blue Apron hit such a speed bump? Because they optimized the recipes and the story for early adopters. They said, this is complicated food for smart people. Well, the number of smart people who want to buy complicated food is not infinite. And so they hit the chasm hard because people who tried it said, I'm not smart enough for this. I don't have time for this. And they left. And instead, they could have hunkered down and said, this is going to take us 10 years. How are we going to gradually earn the trust as it ripples through the community without social media being our metric? Because that's an irrelevant metric. It only makes one company happy, and it's not your company.
In the, I think it was the last chapter of the book, you talked about something that at least came across as being quite personal to you.
Yeah.
Which is the sort of the idea, or at least the question of whether marketing can be evil. And I think you sort of said in response to that, well, it can be both evil and beautiful. And then you cited a bunch of examples of why and when it is evil. And I think this, the same can be said for, because to a certain extent, it's so deeply embedded within marketing that social media can also be sort of
right.
talked about in a similar sort of context. And you know, I engage in this debate. In fact, I have engaged in this debate for the better part of a decade as you know, I challenge a lot of what is happening in our industry and space very deliberately so that I can help people you know, change their own thinking, you know, around social media and its role and role in our lives and the opportunity it represents in terms of marketing. And obviously, social media can be used in a bunch of different ways. It can be used in beautiful ways, and there are countless examples of that. But also, it's very obvious, and particularly when you look at what's happening with the platforms, the amount of control and the power that they currently have, is there are obviously a number of like economic forces that are at work that are not necessarily working in our best interests.
Yep.
And so as we sort of bring, you know, this conversation to a close, I'd love to kind of talk about some of the ways in which you think we should be sort of rising up against these negative forces and how can we make it just more difficult as we think about the next wave of innovation and change? How can we make it more difficult for evil to exist in the world of marketing?
I love this. So some things are a level playing field and some things are tilted. And when a monopolistic organization is responsible for the tilting, it's up to us, the citizens in the culture, to challenge and eventually force the people who have tilted the playing field to untilt it. The magic of the three TV networks for 40 years is because the FCC had oversight and because Spectrum is what gave them their monopoly or their oligopoly, they tilted away from evil. Walter Cronkite didn't do things to make the ratings go up. That they were very thoughtful for a very long time about what messages they would put. Yes, it got us the Brady Bunch, but it also got us the most unified culture that we can remember. As soon as you got rid of that, then there was a race to the bottom. Because someone with a cable network says, oh, but if I can just have more fights, I'll get more viewers. If I get more views, I can sell more ads. If I sell more ads, I can make more money. And so the good news gets drowned out by the bad news because humans are humans and we rubberneck, right? But then when Facebook comes along and it's a monopoly in the sense that they get to decide the architecture, they can't say it's level and that every idea is on its own. They've tilted it. And they've tilted it in various directions that a lot of people are now saying aren't making us happier, aren't making our society better, aren't leading to where we need to go. That doesn't mean free speech should be stopped. It just means you need to untilt it so that it's better tomorrow than it is today in terms of what we hear, what we're exposed to, and how it engages with our lives. Or the iPhone, right? The iPhone is tilted to create addicts. The iPhone is tilted to disconnect us from our everyday life because it's in the interest of the people who are designing it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with speaking up about this because what we know is that an individual who tries to fix it should be proud of the work they're doing, but human nature being what it is, they will likely be drowned out by short-term profit seekers. And so I look back at 30 years of me doing this stuff. And I'm proud of the things that I did. I'm happy to confess in 1995, 94, when most people listening to this were not online, some of which weren't even alive, I spammed a news group because I said, I wonder how that works. And I love, in retrospect, the 40 people who spanked me instantly. It was a youth group for people who play chess. And I put up an ad there to see what would happen. And I said, I'm never doing this again. And so since then, I've been proud of the way that I put my work up. But I am not proud as a citizen of the world or of the country to see what works better to get people's attention, because it's tilted. And so my rant is, if enough of us say to people who want to be part of our culture, you can't be part of our culture if you're going to keep it tilted, then they'll start to untilt it, even though the short-term stock price will go down. In the long run, we'll end up with a place where it was worth making the money for in the first place.
I mean, you think about Facebook in particular, and I don't want to single them out separate from the other platforms, because I just, you know, I feel that, like,
it's all the same thing.
But they're obviously under fire, and you know, the spotlight is shining brighter on them than probably any other technology company. And the reason why that's the case is because Mark Zuckerberg is so vocal and so idealistic about the mission of Facebook, which is...
That's why they're under fire, or that's why it's tilted?
Well, let me finish the question, because I guess what I mean is they're under fire because of the fact that, like, he's out there talking about something that feels very idealistic, which is their mission, which is, of course, as you say, at odds with the economic model, the means by which they make money. And the argument is, look, we don't want to charge people a subscription to access this because we think it should be free and open and available to everybody. But obviously the economics of their business is at odds with their mission. And I guess my question is, I mean, is that what you mean when you're talking about tilted? And when you talk about, like, how do you then, like, you know, even it out or level the playing field, are you seeing anything today that's pointing perhaps to, like, what that might look like in the future?
Okay, so the short-term economic interest of every entity that I can think of is against doing the right thing in the short term, right? The surgeon could use fewer stitches and save a nickel. Starbucks could water down the coffee and save a nickel. It's the only question is, when does the short run become the long run? So in the case of Facebook, their economic interest, which is what, I don't know, 100,000 people at Facebook keep track of because they have stock options, is how do we get today people to do things that aren't in their interest or the culture's interest? So that's not Mark doing it. It's not Sheryl doing it. It's someone 6 reporting levels down who's got this little box they're in, and they're trying to make a number go up. It's the wrong number. They're not playing the right long-term game. So we can hate AT&T for being a monopoly for 50 years, but they played the right long-term game, which is, we're not going to make shortcuts. We just want people to talk on the phone. But at Facebook, that's not the thing, because they're under huge pressure to make the quarterly numbers. If I think about Twitter, right? The point of what Twitter measures, they made a huge mistake before they went public. They could have been a membership site and had plenty of profit. If they were a membership site, everything about the thing would have been different. So what I'm saying to people who are architecting the way we are going to spend our days is, tell us the truth about what you're maximizing. Let us be clear with each other, because you're a monopoly, whether that's something we want maximized. We wanted AT&T to maximize our ability to make long distance phone calls. I'm not sure we want Twitter to maximize how many spectators a fight can get.
So I sort of, when I think about This Is Marketing in the context of, like, all of your other books, it feels seminal. It feels like something that, as we discussed at the beginning of the conversation, that it was a sort of a culmination of something. So what's next? Like, what's going to come after This Is Marketing?
Well, I'm shifting almost all my attention on the workshops we're building. So This Is Marketing is the textbook for the marketing seminar. And the reason I'm doing that is because watching 10,000 people or more change in real time through direct engagement with each other, that's what I've always wanted to do. I just couldn't do it before. And so the work I'm working on now, the next kind of workshops we're doing, are more about finding our creativity, finding our chance to speak up. So there'll be some of that. But I think that marketing is this extraordinary engine for change. And I could rewrite most of my books every 10 years. It's not getting stale, and it keeps being interesting. For me, and I love that you spent so much time talking to me about all this, thank you. But for me, getting the strategy right is so much more important than getting the tactics right. And I think we got to just walk away from some of our tactical conversations and get back to why are we doing this and who are we doing it for?
Well, this is a perfect way, I think, to wrap up the conversation, Seth. It's been such a pleasure and a privilege for me. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. Go make a ruckus.
Thank you for listening to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. Leads to Scale is edited and produced by Al Manarino. For the latest news and insights, or to learn more information about how to get involved with future Social Media Week events, please visit socialmediaweek.org.